Ian, one wonders what Britain would have, how he would have responded to the glare of publicity in this centenary year, whether it was something he would have actually, as a man and as a composer, relished in any way at all, because he was so private.
I think he was a real, like so many artists, he was really conflicted about publicity and really conflicted about status, and I suppose it was also the English gentleman thing. I mean, he was, you know, presenting himself very clearly as an English gentleman in a sense. So if you look at Gloriana, when he wrote Gloriana, he was absolutely insistent that it was presented as a gala performance in front of the royal family and the great and the good. And then, of course, he suffered this terrible reverse where everybody hated it, and in a way, not surprisingly, because he couldn't write a piece that would conform to people's expectations of what a coronation opera should be. He wrote a complex, ambiguous piece, which is what he was as an artist. So I think he always had this slightly embarrassed conflict about wanting to be in the establishment. He said that thing, if I had been born 200 years ago, I would have been a court composer. That, at the same time, is actually being a very private, tortured, ambiguous artistic creator.
Well, that ambiguity is an interesting one, because there are these contradictions, this profound insecurity and inhibition that you talk about, and the astonishing boldness and confidence of the composition. I mean, it's precisely what he wants it to be, not a note too many or too few.
Yeah, and he only lost that at the end of his life. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Paul Kilday's recent biography, the most interesting thing critically, is the reassessment of the late works and his championing of the late works. And I think he's right to champion them, but when he was writing Death in Venice or The Last String Quartet, he had this uncertainty about him, which he'd never had in his life before. He said to Colin Matthews and David Matthews after the first playthrough of the string quartet, is it okay? And he had sketch material, this sort of thing, whereas before he'd always just had it in his head and it just flowed out.
Classics are releasing 10 albums, new and reissued, during the coming year. You play a significant part in their contribution to the centenary year with three new releases. A disc of song settings with Antonio Pappano at the piano, a new war requiem conducted by Pappano, and live recording from the 2011 Aubra Festival of The Rape of Lucretia. Each of these discs are shining examples, or enshrine shining examples, of his great skills as a word setter. I mean, that was an astonishing gift, and perhaps his greatest gift, would you say?
Yes, and I do see it as a gift, and something that's very difficult to analyse. I mean, he talked about it in terms of recapturing the sort of English word setting that Purcell had managed, but I think it goes beyond that, because he goes beyond Purcell in what he achieved in terms of the breadth of it. I mean, we can argue about whether or not Purcell was a greater composer, but I mean, without a doubt, Britain is the first great opera composer in the English language, because he just obviously had an extraordinary feel for natural English word setting. He takes the poem, he has an idea about it, he grabs it and he sort of takes possession of it, but it remains very convincing always, I think.
Yes, and there's also this innate sense of theatre about his word setting, even outside of opera. A lot of his work is highly theatrical, and that is so instinctive. It's something you cannot be taught.
Thank you.
Well, talking about word setting brings us to his muse, his partner, his rock, Peter Pears. As a tenor, it's a question you must get asked a lot. How difficult is it finding your way independent of the Pears legacy?
I think it, as you work your way into becoming a professional singer, eventually the influence is there, but you leave it behind because you have to find your own ways of doing things, and you're busy and you don't end up listening a lot to other people. I think sometimes the great beauty of his voice, although his voice is not a classically beautiful instrument, he has amazing gift with register and with line and with breath, actually, extraordinary breath. But I think you sing as you sing, and in the end you find your own way. What's interesting about The Great Bear, I think, is, I mean, I haven't sung Grimes, and maybe I never will, but I think if you do try and use a classic sort of technique on that, it doesn't really, I don't think it's written for somebody thinking about that. It's written for somebody who actually uses a lot of head voice all the way through their voice. It's quite an old fact. I mean, I think a Fischer Dieskau does that a lot. It's a lot of sort of this very domey sort of sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've heard the Helden tenors, some of the Helden tenors who are cast in this role now, sort of really have terrible problems with
huge
that piece.
Why haven't you sung Grimes? They're a tall, thin fisherman.
because I think sometimes opera houses are very, very literal-minded. I mean, I really have had people say to me or of me that I would be hopelessly cast as Peter Grimes because he's supposed to be a great big bulky fisherman in one of those jumpers. And I mean, it just so the sort of, I mean, the problem is that, of course, I object to that personally, obviously, because I quite like to sing it, maybe, but I also just think, how daft.
Rome is now ruled by the Etruscan upstart Tarquinius Superbus, king, but once servant to the late monarch Servius. How did Tarquinius reach the throne? By making his own virtues and his will bend to the purpose of determined evil.
I've said he's right up there as an opera composer. I mean, I really think right up there, along with Strauss and in the 20th century, because of the volume of theatre work he wrote, works he wrote for the stage. And I suppose it's easy to say, but his operas were essentially about aspects of himself in so many ways. He chose very, very carefully and specifically. You know, and he was this outsider, this homosexual at a time of illegality, pacifist in a time of war. I mean, that must have had a profound effect on him.
Yes, but again, this extraordinary paradox that he was absolutely in the middle of the establishment, the great cultural figure of the post-war period, friends with the Queen and the Queen Mother, writing these things, making a lot of money. You know, really, and as I said he would have been a court composer, but at the same time, these things made him an outsider. But also, I think there was a natural aversion in him to being too central. He found that there was a sort of embarrassment in it. I mean, as far as the homosexuality goes, his position as this great established composer allowed him to lead a life with Peter Pears, which is a sort of extraordinary portent of what is now happening in terms of gay marriage in here and in America. But, you know, 50 years early. And once they'd got over that very difficult period at the beginning of the 50s when there was quite a lot of hounding of homosexuals in public life, I think he managed a reasonably, you know, I mean, unpleasant, homophobic sniggering, but I think he didn't really prevent him.
It's a ghastly hypocrisy, isn't it, that we now see for what it was.
But I think he did, apart from all that, there's the way in which, as an artist, he wanted to inhabit the centre, but he sort of pulled away from it. So he writes, you know, he's asked to write a grand opera for Covent Garden, and he writes one for all men, so it's sort of not quite in the mainstream.
Yes.
Or he writes this coronation opera and doesn't do quite what he's expected to do. Or he writes these amazing church parable operas in the 60s. Or Death in Venice, and you say that a lot of his operas are about himself, and Death in Venice is so much about himself, and not because it's about somebody who becomes obsessed by a boy, although it's partly about that, but because it's about somebody who is in this position of being, in this case, a literary lion, not a musical lion, but it's about how can you really be a creative artist but be established in this way. What you really need as a creative artist is to expose yourself to the possibility of indignity. And that's a lot of what the opera's about, I think.
That element of contradiction that you feel in Vief particularly, and every time I see Billy Budd, I think, you know, how is it possible this man who knows so well what is going on is able to kind of step back under the cloak of duty and actually let this boy down so criminally? That makes a good theatre, of course.
Yeah.
But
again, it's a piece I haven't done. I mean, I'd love to do on stage and I haven't done yet, so I will understand it better, although I think it, you know, it works very well in concert, but it would be great to explore it on stage.
Yes, and I think all that comes out in the last scene.
But I could have saved him. I could have saved him. He knew it. Even his shipmates knew it. The earthly laws silenced them.
One senses in both those characters, Vier and Aschenbach, a profound loneliness, a terrible loneliness.
Yes, yes.
And one suspects that despite his lifelong union with Piers, that his soul was very lonely. I get that feeling sort of listening to his writing and his music. Do you?
Yes, I do. And I also get a lot of, you know, even in things which are supposed to be celebratory, there's something very dark and lonely going on. I mean, in the Michelangelo sonnets, they're not sort of really straightforward love poems at all. And the relationship with Piers, which is celebrated in one sense in the Michelangelo sonnets, came out of a very complicated situation we increasingly realise, in which he was in love with somebody else but couldn't cope with that relationship. And he was very, I think he was very emotionally needy throughout his life, and Piers, in a sense, didn't always give him what he needed because he was off doing his own thing.
Yes.
And Britain was left to go through this, I mean, this sort of purgatorial career in one sense. I mean, of course, it was all about Britain's career was all about Britain as a great composer, and so in one sense it was all about him. But I think for him it was always really about doing what he saw as his duty, and I mean, working unbelievably hard, punishing himself, and always doing sort of, I mean, he's much criticised for using people, but in another sense, if people approached him in the right way, people like William Plomer, who wrote several of his libretti or the family Piper, they understood what he needed as an artist, and they didn't demand more of him. I think there's one tiny little example where Rostropovich asked, you know, the eight or 10 most distinguished living composers to write variations on a theme for Paul Zacher's 80th or 90th birthday. And Britten was the only one who actually did what he was asked, because he just felt, you know, I've been asked to do this thing and I'll do it, and the others came up with their own pieces because they didn't want to be boxed in, but he had a real sense of just duty.
Upon the street they lie beside the broken.
Turning to Rape of Lucretia, the dark psychology of this piece runs very deep. And are you of the belief that the male chorus, which is the role you sing, is, again, Britten? Because I always think his response to the tale at the end of the opera is markedly different from the female.
And I think that's so crucial, because this, people patronise this piece to bits. And they say it's this, oh God, he imposed this terrible Christian sort of framework, and it's false to what the piece is really about, and it was just stuck on at the end. And it's not true. I mean, it was focused more when the last scene was written, but the conceit is there right from the beginning, the conceit of having these two modern commentators on an ancient story. Lucretia is absolutely... a story from antiquity which was commented on and absorbed into the Christian tradition right from the beginning, from St. Augustine onwards, and then in Renaissance art, in Chaucer. It's a story which has been given a Christian interpretation, a Christian understanding right from the beginning. But I think also, dramatically, if you look at what Britten was interested in at the time, he was very interested in theatrical technique. He was working with Eric Crozier, who was too. There's a sort of Brechtian alienation effect going on, where we've got these narrators, but actually in the course of the opera they are getting more and more involved. So in fact, they're sort of untrustworthy narrators. They're not giving us the moral of the story, they're giving us their understanding. And as you say, crucially at the very end of the piece, the understanding of the female chorus and the male chorus is very, very different.
Tell us about the song disc with Pappano, who is this wonderfully sympathetic musician in every way, I think. He's a terrific pianist.
Wonderful pianist.
Now, the Michelangelo sonnets are so significant because they were the first... It was the first work he wrote for Piers. But tell us about the disc generally.
Well, they're all... I suppose they're all pieces I've been performing for a long, long time, more or less. Winter Words particularly, and Songs from the Chinese, I've been doing for... Well, Winter Words I've been doing continuously, you know, endlessly for 20 years. Songs from the Chinese I did 20 years ago and actually haven't really revisited since, so it was great to go back to those. The others, more or less, a lot. I think there's an enormous variety in them. That's one thing that's very striking. I mean, sometimes you feel there's a sort of similar emotional shape. I mean, if you look at the endings of Winter Words, Michelangelo sonnets, Hölderlin fragments, they all have this similar way of ending with something rather sublime and but grand.
Mm. How long? How long? How long? How long? How long?
I'm interested in what Graham Johnson said in that recent documentary you did about how Britain might have been a completely different composer if he'd gone to Vienna to study with Alban Berg.
Mm.
What an interesting idea.
Mm.
But I'm glad he didn't. Are you?
Yes, I'm glad he avoided sort of issue anything doctrinaire. I think he was always very practical and pragmatic, and I think that's a great thing to be as a composer on the whole.
And also, you know, that what there is a quality in Britain's music that relates to the place he lived and
yes.
and the place he you know, and the world he inhabited, and even that peculiarly English inhibition that we've talked about,
yes.
which plays its part in his pieces.
Yes, but I think his music, I mean, this is something Tony was noticing a lot as we were doing these songs, is how much Britain's music is based on tension and release and relationships of semitones, so we feel more or less I don't think he would have worked well within a system where dissonance had been totally liberated and emancipated. I think he needed that tension and release structure.
Now, as far as War Requiem is concerned, Pace Stravinsky and Pace Boulez, both of whom didn't like it. To me, as with Grimes, this is a shining example of a masterpiece that went straight to the hearts and minds of its audience. I don't think it's any coincidence that Grimes, at its first performance, and War Requiem's first performance, made enormous impacts instantly. There was no question of people saying they recognised what it was.
Yeah.
And for me, it's it's hard to say, but if I had to choose one Britten piece, I think it might be that.
I think it's extraordinary. I mean, I've done it. I think I've done it more than most pieces that I've done. I mean, maybe I've done some of the Schubert cycles more, but I've done it about 60 times, something like that. And it's always a highly effective piece, which is one of the objections to it, I think. And, you know, it's much more cool to be a little bit difficult.
And distance.
Yes.
There's no distance at all.
No.
It's so brutally honest.
And the fear, I mean, you know, maybe it's... I mean, I think Stravinsky was terrified of sentimentality in that way that his generation were, partly because of the First World War and partly because of the sort of late romantic sort of atmosphere in which they grew up. But there is a place for a certain sort of sentimentality or certainly connected feeling which people relate to and which I think works.
It's going to be interesting hearing it with the Santa Cecilia chorus because that wonderful dark...
Yes,
churchy
yes,
Italian
yes.
sound that they make. And of course, you know, you again have the sound of Piers in your head in the Agnus Dei with that.
Which really was, I think, that's an example of a piece that was really written for what Piers could do. And actually, one thing I've noticed is that Britten does very often do that. He'll give, whenever he gives a sort of plum, he always makes sure he gives a really plum piece to Piers that we'll get. I mean, whenever I rehearse the War Requiem. It's always the Agnus Dei that the chorus applaud, and it's not because of the way I'm singing it. It's because of it's a piece that somehow invites that in the way that it's written, although it's very subtle. And it's the same. And he always made sure Pierce had a great good deal. I mean, Turn the Screw is a really good example, because there's the poor old governess. She sings all evening this unbelievably hard music, and really there isn't that much music for Peter Quint, but you get the equal billing.
Yes, absolutely. And the last phrase of the Agnus Dei, Domine Nobis Pacem, which is just one of those perfect phrases, but no pressure at all.
No, and I mean, Piers got an amazing breath in that. That's an example of his incredible. But it's typically Britain, the way it's sort of, you change gear halfway through in a very subtle way.
You travel the world, Ian. Does Britain travel with you? I mean, in many respects, yes. I just wonder how what this year is going to do for his music abroad, because some things just don't travel, and certain pieces of his have. Serenade, War Requiem, certainly, and the operas now.
Yeah.
But do you think the doors are going to be opened even wider at the end of this year, or is there something peculiarly English? I mean, it's always inhibited Elgar's presence elsewhere in the world.
I get the impression that it has a wide appeal. I remember I curated a sort of Britain little Britain festival in the Philharmonie at Cologne about 10 years ago, and I was just really struck by how like Tabeard Zimmerman and these very distinguished non-British musicians really took the music and loved it. I suppose the song, I really love the songs, and I of course I want to keep them for myself, and I hate the fact that other people are singing them, because I'd rather do them myself. But on the other hand, it's fantastic, and one wants these, Jonas Kaufmann sings the Michelangelo sonnets, but there's a whole, it could go beyond that. Michelangelo sonnets are right at the beginning of this development as a song composer, and I hope more people sing them.
Knows your soul a sphere or journeying boy? Our lute dreams far above, whence with spacious vision you mark and meet this region of sin that you find you in. But are not all,